This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Coming up, National Geographic explorer Jonathan Colby was at Pierce Cedar Creek Institute in Hastings last week. He's working on finding a fungus, killing frogs around the world and snakes in the Midwest. But first, in Michigan, like other states, sending children to school requires that they be vaccinated. But parents have the option to ask for a waiver. Getting the waiver in Michigan became more difficult in 2014. Now, two state lawmakers have introduced legislation to make it easier once again. Bridge has examined the issue, tracked changes since the new rules on getting an immunization waiver went into effect, and also got reaction to the proposed legislation. Mike Wilkinson is computer-assisted reporting specialist for Bridge. He joins us from the studios of WDET in Detroit. Thanks for being with us, Mike.
Thank you.
So right now, if a parent wants to opt out or have their children opt out of getting vaccinated before they go to school, what do they have to do?
Well, right now they have to go and meet with a health department official in the county in which they live and go over the pros and cons of immunizations and vaccinations. It's a 15 to 30 minute conversation, and it has to be face to face. And so the healthcare official will tell people, here's why we vaccinate, and then we'll outline, in addition to the pros, some of the risks that are there with vaccinations. And after that, if the parent still wants to get a waiver, they can sign it, and their child can be enrolled. So the waivers have not been eliminated by the change. It's just the process. Before, you could come to the school and just, you know, you show up at the school to enroll your kindergartner and you find out you don't have the 9 vaccinations. They can say, well, do you want a waiver for medical, religious, or philosophical reasons? And the parent could say, sure, sign here, boom, you're done. Now, rather than go to the school to get the waiver, they have to schedule an appointment with a health official.
So it used to be easier to get a waiver. When did it become more difficult and why?
Well, in 2014, there was a whooping cough outbreak in northwestern Michigan in the Traverse City area. And one school in particular, Grand Traverse Academy, had a number of those children who had the whooping cough. It turned out that school had 21%, at least in that particular year, 21% of the kindergartners had waivers and were not vaccinated. And that prompted quite a bit of an outcry, and the state rewrote the rules to, rather than have the, you know, real quick, just sign a form, boom, you're done, to requiring parents to get a little bit more education about the value and, again, the risks of vaccinations before they could get the waiver. They could still get the waiver. They just had to spend a little more time.
And have those rules then had an impact on the waiver rate in Michigan?
The waiver rate plummeted. We went from having more than nearly 6% of kids with a waiver to less than 4, which doesn't sound like a big number, but the rate itself fell by a third. It was 2,000 more kids a year were coming to kindergarten fully vaccinated than had been before. So the state looks at this as a fantastic success. Because you want to have as many people as possible immunized, because that can prevent, kind of act as a bulwark when, you know, whooping cough, you know, it still exists. But if people are vaccinated, it will stop when it runs into those people. It won't continue through a community. So the state looked at this change as not that burdensome. It still allowed people to get a waiver, but yet, you know, the waiver rate plummeted, and it felt that more people were protected, not just in schools, but with throughout the state.
And is that an argument for this as public policy, even in the face of, say, somebody who might say, look, you know, if my kid is vaccinated, then, you know, why should I worry? You know, aside from basic care for other people, you know, if my main focus is my own children and their well-being, why should I care that somebody else decides that they don't want to have their child vaccinated?
Well, they say if 95% of the people within a community are vaccinated, you've got this herd immunity that can kind of act as bulwarks when these diseases, which still exist, you know, get introduced to a community. So it's not, I mean, and someone who is vaccinated can be still susceptible down the road, and having more people vaccinated, it just allows for a greater control of when these diseases can, you know, when they are introduced into a community. So it does affect everybody. And even though we're talking mostly about children, obviously the community is bigger than that. I mean, there's, you know, people of all ages that either do or do not have vaccinations. But, you know, the idea is to get them when they're young, because then we protect the broader community.
Now, you do have a map on the Bridge website showing the change in waiver rates by county. So while there is an overall decline in waivers, if you look at some areas, there has actually been an increase in waivers. What trends do you see when you look at that map showing kind of the breakdown of where waivers are being sought?
The biggest drop were in the public schools, where you saw the waiver rate, which was hovering around 5%, go to 3.3. About 1,800 more kids in public schools were getting waivers. The private schools always had a higher waiver rate. You had 10% of the kindergartners in 2014 in the private schools with a waiver. You know, that fell to 7.5. It's still double what the public school rate is. But one of the things that the state found was they feel that so many of the people who had waivers that decided to get their kids vaccinated, it was a convenience thing. They would show up and for whatever reason between, you know, birth and kindergarten, hadn't gotten their children vaccinated. And so when they got to enroll their child, they'd show up at the school and they'd sign the forms. They'd say, oh, do you have your vaccinations? They'd say, no. And they would say, well, you can go to the doctor and get them vaccinated, or you can just sign this waiver. So it became, in many cases, you know, sign it, philosophical reasons, boom, you know, your kid is enrolled and they're not vaccinated. Well, now those people are faced with, you know, they got to either see a doctor or they have to go see the healthcare professional. And they felt that so many of the people who decided to finally get their children vaccinated, it was just a convenience issue, and that this eliminated, it just made it, as they said, they didn't want it to be easier to get a waiver than it was to get a shot. And so you saw a lot of those gains in the public schools. And in the private schools, I mean, it did drop, but not as dramatically as it did in the public schools. But around the state, in West Michigan, you did see a slight increase in some communities. The more populous parts of the state did see the larger declines. Throughout the Detroit area, the middle part of the state, you know, from basically Midland out to just north of Grand Rapids. But out in West Michigan and along Lake Michigan, the waiver rates actually increased.
So now there's a proposal by State Senator Patrick Kolbeck and State Representative Tom Barrett. What would this do?
Well, they want to go back to where you can just sign the waiver at the school. They don't want to require you to meet with the healthcare professional. They believe that is government overreach. And they think, you know, neither of the gentlemen talked to me. I recalled them multiple times and neither returned calls. And so we have to rely on what Kolbeck has said in a statement. But he felt that it was just a too much of a burden on parents to go talk to the government about what their personal concerns were. He's from Canton, and the Plymouth-Canton schools had one of the highest waiver rates. It was about 12%, and it came down substantially to below 5% with the change in the rule. So I would have loved to have talked to him and asked him, you know, if it was something he heard from his community that felt it was burdensome. But, you know, he is a conservative member of the legislature, and he just felt that, you know, this is too much of an overreach. But there's another component of their legislation. There's two bills in the House and two in the Senate, one in the House. They also want to eliminate a provision that would allow a local health department from pulling a child out of school if they're not vaccinated and there were an outbreak of, let's say, measles. You know, what this means is, you know, right now, if there's a measles outbreak at XYZ school in Kalamazoo, and then the local health department looks at the vaccinations and sees that, oh my gosh, here's 10 kids that don't have it, they're exposed. They have the power now to pull those kids out of school during the outbreak. And in a way to protect them and to hopefully stop the outbreak from spreading. Well, this bill would also eliminate that pressure. You could still do it, but only in cases of very large outbreaks. And public health officials in Michigan are very unhappy with that part of the provision, because they consider that one of the best tools to combat these diseases when they do break out.
And again, you did not have the chance to talk to either of these gentlemen, so the reasons for putting that into legislation and proposing it are at this point a little bit vague to us.
Yes, I called both of them several times and they did not return the calls. I would have loved to have asked them about this, because I mean, I think the health department officials want to ask them about it. And, you know, hopefully if it ever gets to a hearing in a committee in Lansing, these questions will be asked and answered.
So you mentioned that health officials are not real happy when they look at this bill. What do they see, and what are their main concerns about what happens if we go back to the old system, which would make it easier to get a waiver before a child goes to school and a waiver from getting immunizations, vaccinations, et cetera?
Well, I talked to Terry Adams, who is a registered nurse and kind of the head of the immunization section of the Department of Health and Human Services, and she's devastated by the introduction of these bills. You know, she and others within the health department look at it as a great success that these waiver rates came down, and they don't want to see it go back in the other direction. You know, they were there when the whooping cough outbreak occurred in northern Michigan. You know, there are still cases of measles every year, of mumps, and they look at this as a step backward. Michigan is, you know, one of only 18 states now that allows parents to get a waiver for three different reasons: religious, medical, or philosophical. And, you know, we have one of the higher waiver rates in the country. And they don't want to go back to the situation where you could just, you know, you're enrolling your kid at the school and just check a box and your kid gets to go in unvaccinated. They want parents to be more aware of the pros and cons, and they don't want to take away the ability to get the waiver, but they just want to make sure that they have all the information that they can have before they make that decision.
So there's also some educators quoted in this story who seem for the most part to be deferring to parents' wishes on the question of immunization. They say it's really not an education issue per se, it's a parent issue. Were these educators also a little reluctant to talk to you?
And there were, we called 8 schools with the highest rates that had, you know, at least 25 kids, 25 kindergartners. Only 2 of them called us back. They I think as an educator, you don't want to speak for your parents, and you don't want to, you know, demonize, for lack of a better word, your parents. You want to be supportive. So I understand some of their reluctance. You know, they're not going to deny a kid because they come in with a waiver. So there was a little bit of a reluctance to talk about this.
But does that case up in Grand Traverse County and the whooping cough outbreak indicate that, you know, this is an issue that schools may have to deal with? They could have, you know, large-scale absences and those sort of things if, in fact, you have people who are not getting immunized, if you have a higher rate of children who don't get vaccinated.
Well, I would presume that those schools have dealt with that. And I don't know if I don't know if Grand Traverse Academy took on a campaign to advocate for vaccinations, but at the year of the breakout, 21% of kindergartners were not vaccinated. Last year, just 7% were. So, you know, the incident itself might have educated the community and the families, and just as much as the schools might have. But yeah, obviously, you can see it as being a concern. You know, everyone knows that, you know, elementary school math and what you learn on Tuesday, you're going to use on Wednesday. And if you're not there Tuesday, you're at a disadvantage. So I don't know what the schools are doing to advocate for immunization. I would presume some do. But, you know, a lot of these schools are charter schools, they're private schools. And so we don't really know the levels to which, you know, they communicate with their community within the school community on these issues.
Any word on the legislature or committees in the House and Senate taking up the bills which have been proposed by Senator Colbeck and Representative Barrett?
Hearings have not been set for them as of yet. They were introduced a couple weeks ago, and they're waiting to be, they're in the Education Committee in the Senate, just waiting to see what happens next. I mean, in the House, there were a dozen co-sponsors. So, I mean, there is some support for the idea. We'll just have to see whether it plays out. You know, the legislature has a few things on its plate right now with the budget and, you know, proposals for possibly a tax cut or change, you know, K-12 education. I mean, the teachers' retirement benefits. So I'm not sure where this fits into the broad perspective of things that they have to do. But, you know, they were introduced, and there appears to be some support for at least having a conversation about them.
Mike Wilkinson is computer-assisted reporting specialist for Bridge. He joined us from the studios of WDET in Detroit. Thank you very much for your time, Mike.
I appreciate you having me.
Bridge's reporting on getting a vaccination waiver in Michigan can be found at bridgemi.com and through links at wmuk.org. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Jonathan Colby has spent more than a decade studying frogs. The National Geographic explorer spends much of his time in Honduras trying to save species of frogs from extinction.
I think it's unfortunate that the first major wildlife disease outbreak on the world is affecting frogs, because a lot of people don't perceive frogs as charismatic and cute and important. But frogs have amazing personalities themselves. They are just as important in the environment as these large animals as well. And they're beautiful.
Last week, Colby was at the Pierce Cedar Creek Institute in Hastings. He spent some time filming snakes, also at risk due to a deadly fungus. Colby gave a lecture at the nonprofit Environmental Education Center and then sat down for an interview.
Thank you very much for taking some time to talk with me.
Thanks for having me.
So you're here specifically to look at the Massasauga, Eastern Massasauga rattlesnake, but it's related to some other research you're doing. Explain what the connection is.
Yeah, so I'm really interested in what's happening here with the Eastern Massasaugas and snakes in general due to something called snake fungal disease, which is a fungal infection that is affecting snakes in the United States. And the reason I'm interested in it is because it shares a lot of similarities with my long-term research looking at amphibian chytrid fungus.
And specifically, what you've been studying are frogs, specifically in Honduras.
Yes, I've been studying frogs and how they respond to chytrid fungus in Honduras for almost 10 years now.
And this is, as you describe it, a very unusual event. I mean, it's historic in some ways, right?
Yeah. Right now, there is a global extinction event involving amphibians, largely due to the spread of amphibian chytrid fungus.
Do we know how it got started?
We have a lot of ideas about how it might have gotten started, but there's still more questions than answers. And that's part of the reason why diseases affecting wildlife in general are important to raise more awareness about, because once they spread long and far, it becomes very, very challenging to understand the root cause and how to mitigate the negative impact.
So some of the things which you have done to try and track this are pretty interesting. Skin swabs. How hard is it to skin swab a frog?
It's pretty easy to skin swab a frog. The hard part is sometimes catching them. They sometimes go places that are hard to reach or underwater, but once you've got them, you know, you get a good frog grip and they usually calm down.
You've also done radio tracking. How difficult is that to do and how accurate is it?
So radio tracking is something really fun and exciting that we've done for frogs. There's some miniature radio transmitters that you can actually attach to little waist belts that you can make for the frogs to wear, like a backpack. And those actually have very short ranges because they're so small and light. But probably the biggest challenge of using those in some forests that we work in is using them in areas that have cliffs. We learned that sometimes the frogs like to go to the cliffs, and we don't necessarily.
You don't want to go to the cliffs.
I don't mind going to the cliffs, but I mind following the frog along the cliff, yes.
Should we be really worried about frogs? I'm sure there's a lot of people who say, look, I don't see frogs that often. I don't have a pet frog. I find frogs. I don't eat frog legs. Why should the average citizen be concerned?
So there's a lot of reasons why frogs and amphibians in general are important. They're environmental indicators because their skin is so permeable to their environment. Usually if amphibians start to disappear from a landscape, something is wrong. It could be something like pollution or climate change or something that would eventually affect humans, and the disappearance of these animals could be a sign that we need to pay more attention to the world around us. They also help keep the water clean, because their juvenile larvae will consume a lot of plant matter, which otherwise would just rot. So they do a lot of services to keep the environment healthy. And I think that in the bigger picture, a more theoretical question about why frogs are important is kind of more along the lines of humans having to start making the decisions about what species will and won't go extinct. You know, we've come to a period in time when the environment and so many things are changing that a lot of wildlife species are running out of habitat, and a lot of them are already endangered. And we only have limited funds and resources to actually bring some of these animals back. And they're very hard decisions to make. And you get to the point where you have to start making those decisions about what species are important. And that is a very hard question to answer, because you're kind of comparing unknowns. And I particularly like the analogy to an airplane, where if you imagine the environment as an airplane with lots of moving parts and nuts and bolts, and each species is one of those nuts and bolts, and you might have some of them fall off, and everything is fine. It doesn't look different, it still flies. But at some point, one of those will be the bolt that holds the wing together, and then you crash. And it's hard to predict how or when that might happen. But by the time you notice things are really bad, it's usually beyond the point of fixing them. So it's more the question of protecting nature as a whole, and that each piece matters in its own little way.
In other words, if there is something that is in nature and exists within our environment that can cause a species or several species to go extinct, at some point that does mean something to human beings. Maybe not necessarily the extinction of the human species, but it's going to change our life in some meaningful way eventually. Is that what you're saying?
Absolutely, yeah. Even though it's sometimes difficult to give people like precise numbers and times and estimates, it's an increasingly well-known fact that we are part of the landscape, we are part of the environment, and that the health of the environment directly impacts the health of humans. And protecting biodiversity keeps the environment healthy, and in the end, that benefits us.
In a film which you showed to the audience here at the Pierce Cedar Creek Institute, you actually say that in some ways it's unfortunate that it's a species of frogs which is endangered, because that's not the sort of thing that gets the public's attention. In other words, if it's an amphibian, they're not cute. It's not a seal. I mean, a lot of people think seals are very adorable, but some people don't think frogs are that adorable. Is that part of what you're working against right now?
Absolutely, yeah. And I think it's really important for us as scientists to communicate to the public and try to reach out to different audiences and explain why these things matter and why they're important. And it is a bit challenging, you know, having frogs as your focal point. Not necessarily whether or not they're charismatic, but that it is easy for them to disappear and people don't notice it. And it's really kind of the first effect on a global scale of the interconnectedness of the world and the spread of pathogens, which will just continue into the future. And, you know, we are now contending with other pathogens like bat white nose syndrome and a newly discovered salamander chytrid fungus. And here, now we also have snake fungal disease. And little by little, a lot of these diseases are emerging in species that don't get a lot of attention. But the issue itself is very important.
And one of the things that you point out is that travel has become easier on a global scale, that things which might have killed many animals in one part of the world in the past did not get to the other part of the world. Now that may not be the case. What do you do about that? I mean, what's the right step to take from a public policy standpoint, for, you know, scientists, for just the public at large?
I think it's a combination of all those factors you mentioned. I mean, from a public policy standpoint, you know, some of these issues have just evolved so quickly that back in the day when a lot of current laws were created about controlling the movement of diseases, we didn't think that this would kind of blow up in our faces. So there's a bit of a lag effect now where we don't really have policies that can help us slow the spread of diseases. So there's definitely a need for that, especially for wildlife. For the normal, you know, public at large, I think it's also just very important to raise awareness to them that actions that they do themselves can make a difference, such as not releasing unwanted pets into the wild where they think they might be doing something really good if they can't care for the animal. But because those animals that came from the pet trade might have been in contact with pathogens from other continents, they could accidentally be spreading things into the wild that they wouldn't necessarily think.
You had a pretty unusual experience of finding a frog which everybody thought was extinct. When did you realize that you had made this discovery?
So that's a bit of a funny story. I saw it one night, and I was in the forest just doing a biodiversity survey when I didn't really know the species very well that I was monitoring. It was my first time in Honduras, and I had a group of students out with me at night, and I saw this frog, which was very different than all of the other ones I'd seen that summer. So I kind of had an inclination that, even though I didn't know what it was, that it was something important and something special. So I dove down to catch it and show these students, you know, how you catch a frog. And I just came up with a handful of mud and spent the next half hour crawling hands and knees looking for this brown nondescript frog, with students just questioning why I'm just so crazy about this silly frog. And I just had to give up. And then it was actually 1 year later that I went back to the exact same spot. One night, I had one chance to go to the same part of the rainforest and literally saw potentially the same frog or very similar looking frog on the very same rock that I saw it the year before. And this time I caught it and was able to get a really good look at it and had a pretty good idea that it was this frog that had been missing for a good 25 years.
Wow. You would think after 25 years, either it was really extinct or somewhere, sometime along the way, someone would have found it.
Yeah, I think that it's most likely that this frog was, you know, the decline in this species potentially earmarked the arrival of chytrid fungus in this part of Central America. And this once common species just, you know, over the course of a year or so, just perished for the most part. And there were still some animals that were hanging on, and this is potentially, you know, one of those small relic populations that might still be clinging on. So it gives me hope that there might be more species out there that we may think are extinct, that there could be some left. And that, although it gives me hope that we can protect some of these species, it's also a reason to just, you know, raise greater awareness to not let these things get to that point where bringing them back from the brink is just so incredibly difficult.
So one of the things you told this audience here at the Pierce Cedar Creek Institute is that it's not too late. There is still time. But as someone who has really studied this, at what point do you get concerned that the clock is really ticking and that maybe it is too late? Are there signs that perhaps this could be irreversible?
I mean, to an extent, it is irreversible. As I mentioned, once a forest or a habitat becomes established with this pathogen, we can't specifically remove it. And then it becomes a challenging dance between managing the pathogen and keeping the species in the habitat, which isn't always possible. So I think what's important moving forward is a combination between focusing a lot of research effort on protecting these critically endangered species that are going to require a lot of resources, but just as much in protecting common species, which isn't often spoken about. I think the return that you get from keeping common species common is often much greater than what you need to invest in bringing an endangered species back from the brink. So there's certainly time to protect a lot of biodiversity out there from, you know, advancing threats. What I am more concerned about are additional threats on top of things like chytrid, such as deforestation and climate change. So, you know, meanwhile, myself and lots of colleagues are doing everything we can to figure out this disease event. You know, we're surrounded by additional pressures, and, you know, those alone are enough to make species go extinct. So it's a challenging mixture of threats that are just increasing every day.
Jonathan Colby, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Jonathan Colby is a National Geographic explorer and conservationist. I spoke with him last week at the Pierce Cedar Creek Institute in Hastings. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.